Welcome to the Victoria's Parenting Podcast. I'm your host, Arabella Hill. Today, I'm going to be talking about the subtle use of manipulation tactics. As parents, our aim is to nurture and guide, but sometimes without realizing it, we might use manipulation tactics when disciplining. And these tactics often negatively impact behavioral outcomes in children. So today we're unpacking what some of these tactics are, how they affect children, and most importantly, how we can foster healthy, open communication with our children instead of resorting to these communication tactics that end up being manipulation. So let's start with revision of reality. So a revision of reality is a form of emotional manipulation where the facts and events are twisted or downplayed. So this tactic can sow doubt, guilt, or confusion, making it a key tool in manipulative behaviors. Recognizing it is the first step towards safeguarding your emotional well-being if someone is doing this to you, or looking at yourself if you are inadvertently doing this to your child when disciplining. So here's one theoretical example of this. Let's say Sam becomes very upset with his teenager, Alex, for not cleaning his room, leading to a heated argument. During the argument, Sam shouts, "You never listen to me or do anything I ask." A few days later, when discussing the argument with another family member, Alex recalls Sam shouting. However, Sam interjects saying, "I never raise my voice, and I certainly didn't say you never do anything I ask. You're just too sensitive and exaggerating things." In this example, Sam is outright denying their actions and words, despite Alex's clear memory of the event. This manipulative tactic attempts to make Alex question their own memory and perception of the incident, and it shifts the blame and responsibility away from Sam's behavior onto Alex. And it can leave Alex feeling confused, doubting his own experiences, and questioning their own emotional responses. While Sam may have done this because he's embarrassed and doing this to protect himself, no one wants to have this conversation with other people, so perhaps inappropriately Alex was saying something to another family member that he shouldn't have. Maybe it should have just been between Sam and Alex. But then again, maybe Alex needed to vent to somebody. In any case, when Sam outright denied this, what he was doing is called revisioning. So he may have been embarrassed, but it's still emotional manipulation and it damages the parent-child bond. In this scenario, Sam should have admitted what happened and said, "Yes, I yelled at you. We did have an argument. I am frustrated with how many times I have to ask you to clean your room and you don't. And it feels like you don't listen to me most of the time." And see, instead of outright denying that it ever happened and then saying you're always exaggerating or stop exaggerating or I never did that, Sam is opening a line of communication by admitting that, "Yes, I did say this. We did have an argument. I did yell at you, and I'm not happy with how that situation went. But the reason behind this is because I'm frustrated. Every time I ask you to clean your room, you say you will. I go back in there and it's not done. And I feel like you just don't listen to me." So by saying that, Sam can then open the doors to Alex to have a conversation. Hopefully Sam is saying this in a very calm but authoritative manner, not lording himself over Alex or talking down to him, but doing that in a way that opens the door of communication. Then perhaps saying to Alex, "Look, I want to talk about this with you. I don't want to leave things the way they are." So, and then wait to see what Alex has to say and then have a conversation back and forth. It doesn't mean that what Alex says in return is going to be necessarily factually correct, because teenagers and young children, they see the world very differently and they're more prone to reacting than to be proactive. So Sam can use that situation to help Alex with his critical thinking and ask him open-ended questions that allows for Alex to talk back to him about his feelings, about the situation, so there can be a two-way conversation. You see, when Sam shut down Alex, he closed the door to communication. And that's something that you never want to do with your children. You always want to be able to open that door to communication with them, especially with teenagers. And yes, they can be infuriating and frustrating. Then some of them, they think they know it all. My son went through that teenage phase. He's 22 years old now. And I fully understand how it feels to have a teenager and to be tired and frustrated. But if you shut down what he is saying, as Sam did with Alex, you are closing the door to communication, and it is a manipulation tactic. It's like, let's sweep this under the rug. Let's forget about it. Let's not talk about this. I don't want to deal with this. And so then your teenager, when they are going through different things, they will behave in the same way when they're feeling pressured and they're feeling frustrated, because you're feeling frustrated and tired, and now you've taught them how to communicate while you're feeling that way. They will copy you. When they're feeling tired and frustrated, they'll shut you down. They won't come to you because you've closed the doors to communication. So the solution in this scenario is communication and strong leadership. If Sam opens the door to communication, he is showing leadership. He's admitting what happened, but he's also telling his side of the story, and he's asking questions to Alex so you can have a conversation back and forth. That's showing strong leadership. By hiding away and saying, "You're exaggerating, be quiet, that never happened," that's not leadership. That's very much the opposite of it. And that seeds a strong, let's say, seed in the child of disrespect. They're not going to respect you for that. They will respect you when you show strong leadership. And opening the door to communication is showing strong leadership, because avoidance will lead to manipulation. And if you've done this once, like if Sam done this once to Alex, he will use that because it's just easier to get out of an awkward situation. You would use it over and over again, and then Alex will use it back at Sam. And what happens? The parent-child bond is then fractured. Alex needs better communication from Sam in this scenario, and Alex isn't going to be the one to do it because he's a child. He needs to be taught how. And how better to teach him how to communicate when you are frustrated, when you are tired, when things aren't going well, is to model that in your own behavior. So that is the manipulation tactic of revision and reality. We're going to have a look at another one now called emotional overload. So what is emotional overload? Emotional overload is used to sway behavior. It leads to confusion, stress, and impaired communication in children. So whether you realize it or not, emotional overload is a manipulation tactic. Parents and teachers often do not realize it, that they're doing this at all. Sometimes, this is very common in women especially, and sometimes we as women, we don't realize how overly emotional about situations that we can get. And it can also happen in men as well. And I had a parent tell me the other day, one of the biggest lessons that he's learned from my material so far is that he often brings bazookas to toothpick fights. I found that analogy quite funny. But it's true, we can end up being overly emotional, making mountains out of molehills, when really the child needed strong leadership. And now we're displaying all kinds of emotional upset and emotional dysregulation. And what we're doing through that is we're teaching our kids how to behave in situations when they are tired and they are frustrated. So it pays to be aware of the ways that you communicate with your child, because how you handle your own frustration and upset is teaching them how to do that themselves. So here is an example. A parent frustrated with their child's messy room starts yelling and crying, saying, "You never listen to me. I do everything for you and I get nothing back. You don't care about anyone but yourself. You're so ungrateful. You're selfish. Why are you doing this to me?" This intense emotional display is obviously intended to make the child clean their room because the parent is frustrated. I want you to clean your room, and the child isn't doing what they're asked to do, or they say they will do it and then don't. So instead of having the other example that I spoke about earlier, where Sam could have opened the door to communication, this particular parent in this scenario is shutting down all communication, and they're making the child's behavior about them. Like, why are you doing this to me? And the reason why I put that particular phrase in this scenario is because I hear this a lot from parents every single day. Why is my child doing this to me? Why are they so ungrateful? Why are they so selfish? Why aren't they listening to me? Why are they attacking me in this way? And it can feel very personal when your child is misbehaving. It feels like at times they are attacking you. But as I say so many times, especially in my Ultimate Guide to Disciplining Without Damage for Every Age ebook, is that it's not a personal thing. Pushing the boundaries is a normal behavior as children grow up. This is a normal part of their development. They actually have to push the boundaries. They have to, in order to learn where the boundaries are. They're not going to just learn by being told. They learn by doing as well. So when they're growing and developing, they will refuse to listen. They will say no. They will talk back to you. They will scream and shout and say, I hate you. They are not doing this to you because they dislike you as a parent or because you're a bad parent. Every child does this to their parents. And as a teacher, I taught children all over the world, China, Dubai, the United States. I taught children from Japan, from the Middle East. And I can tell you, I taught all age ranges, and all children, regardless of their culture and where they come from, regardless if they spoke English as a first language, they all push the boundaries. And all of these parents have experienced the exact same thing. So your child isn't doing this to you. They are behaving this way because their brains and their biology is making them do this so they can learn about the world. And that's where they need strong leadership. Is called emotional overload. These intense emotional displays are intended to make the child clean their room, but instead leaves the child feeling stressed, guilty, and unable to express their feelings or understand how to resolve the situation constructively. So here's the fact. Your job is to protect your child, feed them, clothe them, and nurture them. They cannot provide these things for themselves. So if you throw your service to them back in their face, you are leading them to feel guilty over something they cannot control. It's just like saying, this is my house, but it's your child's house as well. Like, where else are they going to go? What other house are they going to live in? This is mine, you know? And when you make that separation and you make them feel like they're walking on eggshells in a home that they have no choice but to live in, and you have to protect them, feed them, clothe them, and nurture them. They can't do that themselves. But when you use emotional overload to throw your service back in their face, it's giving them anxiety. It's fracturing your bond. It's creating confusion. It's making them feel guilty and in pain over something they cannot control. They cannot look after or provide for themselves. They cannot put a roof over their own heads. So when you throw that back in their face, it creates confusion. They can't care for themselves, like I said. So when you say, I do everything for you, you are so ungrateful. You are expecting them to understand at a mature level of awareness. You are asking them to be grateful for something that you've got to do anyway, something that they have always known. But being grateful requires self-awareness. It also requires experience in the world to compare it to. Kids have a limited ability to look introspectively. They have a limited self-awareness. It's growing as they grow. They learn from you, and they have very limited experience in the world, so they don't have a lot to compare it to. We can only be grateful as adults because we have something previously that we can compare it to. For example, I'm really grateful for a smartphone because it allows me to do a lot of work from a very small device. I'm grateful for this smartphone because I know what it's like to use a phone that wasn't a smartphone, that didn't have the internet, that didn't have email. I can do everything that I want to do, including recording this podcast episode from my smartphone. So I have a gratitude about the things that I have because I have a comparison that wherein I didn't have that. Your child can't compare their current situation to anything else because this is all they have known. So telling them that they are ungrateful is kind of a moot point. They can't be grateful for something they have no other experience in. And they may never be grateful for all the very small or little things that you do for them that build up every single day. But as adults and as young teens, they will be grateful for you having their back. They will be grateful for you being a trustworthy person that they can go to at any time. And they will be grateful for having somebody, a parent who is emotionally safe, someone who they can trust, someone who they can confide in, who isn't going to tell their secrets and the things that are going on in their lives to the entire family. Those are the things that really matter. Those are the things that we should be really striving for our kids to be grateful for. And how can we do that? Is to give them experience of that. Have their back, be a trustworthy person, and be emotionally safe for them, and don't use emotional manipulation tactics when disciplining them. Use strong leadership and you will breed gratefulness in them. Gratefulness doesn't come by telling someone to be grateful. It comes from experience and wanting. It has to come from inside them. It can't be forced on the outside. So in the above scenario, nothing gets resolved and everyone feels intense pressure and stress. The child feels conflicted because their natural instinct of children, especially when they're very young and they end up learning something different as they get older. But very young children, there have been examples and experiments shown that their natural instinct is to please their parents because you are their only source of survival as they are growing. So when you say and you shut down communication and say, you always do this, you never do this, and you're using emotional overload because you're just frustrated, internally it makes your child feel conflicted. And it can ignite a freeze or fawn response at first, which is more common when they are little, but when they get older as teens, it's more likely to ignite a fight response. It can even happen in like 6, 7, 8 year olds. No longer are they feeling free, like frozen or confused. They've now had years to process because this is the normal communication that they get from you. Now they're fighting back. Now your child is fighting back with you. They've had enough of the intense emotional display. The stress that builds up within them, it has to go somewhere, and now it is directed at you. And what that behavior is saying is, I need you to lead me. They are crying out for strong leadership. Using revision of facts, emotional overload is not leadership. They are manipulation tactics, and it will only backfire and make their behavior a lot worse. So when someone feels stress, think of it as building up. As adults, when we have this buildup of stress, we have often the experience and wisdom to deal with that stress, but kids don't. The stress has to be released somewhere, and it's often directed at you. Some kids may then inflict internal pain upon themselves. They might end up pulling their hair out or thinking that I'm stupid, I can't do anything right. While others, they may just lash out at you, or it could be a combination of all of it. Emotional overload is a covert manipulation tactic that must be brought into the light, and we must look within and be willing to change if we want a better future for our children. So let's look at one of the last manipulation tactics that I'm going to be talking about in this episode. There are a lot of them. I'm not going to be able to do it in every single episode, but I have quite a few of the main ones in this episode. This one is called negging, and I know my accent may not be understood by all, so it's not nagging as if I'm nagging you, it's negging with an E, so N-E-G-G-I-N-G, negging. And it's a different word that most people have never heard of. Basically, negging is a form of emotional manipulation whereby an individual gives a compliment followed by an insult. You may know negging as a backhand compliment. And some people also see it as passive aggressive. But more commonly, we say, oh, that was a backhanded compliment. Well, the official word for it, the psychological word, is called negging. So what is negging? Well, the best way to tell you what that is to give you a lot of examples. Let's say a parent tells their child, you're smart, but I guess you're just not smart enough to figure out math like your sister. Maybe if you tried harder, you'd be able to understand it. So using a backhanded compliment to motivate the child instead undermines their confidence and self-esteem. So using negging where you're giving a compliment and it could come second or it could come first to a criticism, the child isn't going to hear the compliment or think that your compliment is genuine. In fact, when someone does that, the compliment isn't genuine. It's just used as a manipulation tactic to try and soften the criticism of what they want to say. And there are other ways to help and motivate a child who isn't that good at math. You don't need to criticize them and compare them to another child like that. And when you use negging, I think negging is like one of the worst forms of emotional manipulation because it can be done so subtly and it can be done by a person who's smiling, who gives you a hug. It's like giving you a hug and then slapping you with the same hand. It's exactly like that. And it is very confusing for children when they experience this from their caregivers. It can be very, is this person complimenting me? Do they think I'm really smart? It's confusing. They don't know what to do with this information. So here are some more examples of negging or backhanded compliments. After a child wins a local art contest, the parent says, "That's great, but imagine if you actually spent more time on it, you could do so much better." So this could be said with a smile, with a hug. That person could be hugging their child. "It's great, you won the art contest, but imagine if you spent more time on it, you could do even better than this." Maybe the parent is saying that because they think they're motivating the child, but this is negging. This is a backhanded compliment. This is backing up a compliment with a criticism. If you want to help your child spend more time on their art, you could say that at a separate time. But in this situation, the child just won a local art contest and this person is criticizing and complimenting in the very same sentence, and it is very manipulative. The child then feels deflated because they're on such a high and excited about the art contest, and now they're being told, well, actually, it's not really good enough. That's what they hear in this. So when the parent says, but imagine if you actually spent more time on it, you could do so much better, what the child is hearing is that you're not good enough. That's what the child hears. It doesn't matter how flowery or how sweet you make this, how much you're hugging them, or I love you, and say it with a smile, your child hears, I am not good enough. My mom or my dad doesn't think that I am good enough. That's what they hear. That's all they hear. And it rings in their head like a bell that keeps going off. I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough. Or that wasn't good enough. And that's not good. It can lower their self-esteem. It can fracture your bond. And it can make them feel that they're just never going to live up to your standards. And you're not exactly outlining your standards, obviously, in these sentences, But as you can see, nagging can be very covert, and that's how children hear it. Here are some more examples. You're pretty smart for someone who spends so much time on video games. Imagine if you read books instead. That's starting an argument right there, especially if you say that to a teenager. Get ready for a fight, because if you wanted one, you're definitely going to get one, especially if you're standing right over with your hands on your hips at your teenager saying this. Instead of saying, you're pretty smart for someone who spends so much time on video games, imagine if you read books instead, you could sit down with your teenager and ask them what they like about video games. Why are they spending so much time on video games? What is it that they are getting from it? Sit down and play some video games with them. Let them teach you what they see. And so the goal in this is to understand from your child's perspective, to put yourself in their shoes and try to understand how they are thinking. Because when you can understand from their perspective and how they are thinking and their thought process, then you can interject and say, that's amazing. I'm glad you like to spend a lot of time on these video games because you're wanting to meet more people. Well, how about if we do this and this, and you know, I take you to Boy Scouts or something once a week, and then you can meet people in real life? Or how about I take you to, you know, a Pokemon trading club or something like that, where you can meet other kids face to face? My son particularly was very interested in video games, and where I lived, we had a very small store. I can't remember what it was called, but they sold comic books and figurines. And in the back, they had all these computers where you can go and rent out the computer and you can do battles with other people, play video games. And it wasn't very expensive. There was a few of them dotted around. We had something like this at our library as well. And my son wanted to play video games because he was interested in the challenge. He liked to be challenged. And some of these video games are very challenging. I saw that he was very smart. He wanted something that would really push him to his limits and something that he could constantly overcome. And that's what he was getting from these games. And he also wanted the social interaction he was getting from other players. And so then I would take him to these clubs. And the great thing is, because he got out of the house, he got to meet other people, he increased his social connections, and he was doing something that he enjoyed as well at the same time. So that's how you can help your child and encourage them to do different things. If they are stuck on the iPad or the iPhone or something, get into their head, ask them what they are getting out of it. Perhaps they're just bored and they don't have anything else to do, and now it's become a habit. Perhaps they're now addicted to these devices because that's all they ever know. They don't know how to ease their own boredom. But until you converse with them, or if they're very young and they can't speak to you yet in that way, watch their behavior and be a little bit of a detective and have a look at what they're actually getting from these things. And then you will be better equipped to help them from a leadership position rather than using an emotional tactic like negging to try and get what you want from them. So let's look at some more examples of negging. As the child practices piano, the parent says, well, at least you're not completely tone deaf. With a lot of work, you might actually play the song right. So a child is trying to practice piano, and what the child hears is, you're not good enough. You're not good enough. So it's the same as the first one. Let's have a look at another one. After a child spends hours on homework, the parent remarks, you finally finished? I guess you're not as quick as your classmates, but maybe you should work on your speed. So in this case, maybe the parent is trying to encourage the child to go a little bit faster. Oh, look what your friend is doing. They finished in like an hour. You spent hours doing it. But your child doesn't get motivated by you comparing them to their classmates or their siblings or their cousins or anyone else. It actually demotivates them. All they hear is, I'm not good enough. Let's have a look at the next one. Your cousin always gets straight A's and plays sports. It's interesting how different you two are, considering you barely pass and don't do much else. I've heard this a lot from grandparents. My own grandparent used to say things like this as well to us, to myself and to my cousin. She would give backhanded compliments to me and to my cousin. So for a while, I always thought that my cousin was like this perfect person who could never do any wrong. And then I saw my grandmother interact with my cousin and realize, wow, she's doing the same thing to my cousin as well. She's making us both feel terrible and comparing us to everybody else. Don't compare your child to their sibling, to yourself, to anyone. Your child's success is determined by their own baseline. And as a teacher, that is what made a difference in my classroom when I was teaching a variety of children that had different needs. Some had ASD, some had ADHD, some just had basic learning difficulties. And what I did with every single one of them is I judged them on their baseline, not at what necessarily I expected them or what their parent expected them. And so I would look at their baseline. When a child first started with me, I would record all of their baselines and give them very simple little tests so I can judge where they are at developmentally, where they are at academically, and I would make notes of it. And then I would approach the parent saying, you want them to be like this person in the class, but this person in the class is much more advanced for whatever reason, and your child is at this level. Let's look at your child's baseline and let's work from there. It's never a healthy thing to compare a child to everybody else around them. They should be competing with their best self. Their self yesterday, do better than they could do yesterday with themselves, because comparison in that context can demotivate a child, and all they hear is, I'm not good enough. And what happens is that you shut the door to communication, they shut down, behavior gets worse. So let's have a look at another one. A parent watches their child preparing a simple meal and comments, are you sure you can handle that? Last time you tried, it was barely edible. Maybe stick to something a bit more simple. Children, even I'm talking about teenagers. When I say children, I mean 1 to 19. They need challenging all the way through their childhood. Children love to be challenged. They love it. And they don't like to be challenged when they are compared to other people and when you are using emotional manipulation tactics to try and motivate them, you will find that they are demotivated and they don't want to be challenged anymore and they start fighting with you and they start shutting down. So by doing this and not allowing them to try something that perhaps is a little bit too hard for them, maybe you should stand there and help them and guide them without interjecting too much, but just be a help to them. But then this parent in this scenario is just shutting the child down. And this just all the child is going to hear is that I'm not good at this. I can't do this. I've hurt my family because the meal that I tried to prepare was barely edible. I'm simple. That's what they're going to hear. They're not going to hear anything encouraging out of that. They're going to hear, I'm simple. I'm not smart. I can't do it. You see, so negging makes a child feel unworthy. It reduces their trust in you. And that's a major thing because without trust, you don't have any kind of relationship. And so it's imperative to keep the trust flowing in your relationship with your child. And also it lowers their self-esteem. As you can hear in all of the examples I've given, all a child hears is, I'm not good enough. I can't do this. My parent is unhappy with me. I can never do anything right. It shuts the door to communication. It doesn't open it. It demotivates them. A lot of children will take that internally and it will come out in their behavior. They will either go very, very quiet and just won't talk to you and shut themselves in their room all the time. Or they may lash out at you and be more willing to fight with you. What they are crying out for is strong leadership. And like I said, my grandmother used this tactic and so did my mother. So I'm coming from a place of being in a position as a child, having these emotional manipulation tactics done to me throughout my entire childhood, affecting me, direly affecting me in adulthood. I didn't make such great decisions for my own life because I was brought up in this way and I couldn't see my own worth. I thought that I was stupid for a very, very long time. I would have nagging done to me by teachers as well. You're just not good at this. It wasn't that I wasn't good at particular things. It was that my parents had moved us around so much and I never had the stability at home or anywhere else throughout my childhood in order to learn certain things. So I left school with hardly any grades thinking, you know what, I'm just dumb. I don't get it. And people used to buy into that narrative that I would tell myself. So I ended up surrounding myself with friends who would reinforce that narrative. And they would pat me on the head and say, you should have been born blonde. You're not very smart. And ha, ha, ha. And I didn't see it as anything else but the norm because that's all I grew up with. These emotional manipulation tactics. I didn't feel that I had any worth in me, and it took a very long time as an adult to undo all that and to learn something new and to get out of it. And you really don't want to be doing that to your child. That's very, very difficult. It's painful to have to go through that when you think that you're never good enough, you can never live up to anybody's standards, you know, that your parents, like, you got to stick to something simple. All of these things where you're just shutting down communication over and over and over again. And then you're wondering, why doesn't my child want to speak to me when they move out? And there is a big movement of parents that I see on TikTok and the internet who are estranged parents and they're wondering why their children aren't speaking to them and they're going off into the world as adults and they don't want to come home on a Sunday for Sunday meals and things like that. I'm not saying this is true in all cases, but I would say a lot of the cases is because the child has experienced throughout their childhood the adult that they were craving strong leadership from, continually to shut down all lines of communication over and over. And as adults, the stress has to go somewhere, it builds up and you get sick of it. You can't take it anymore. You just want to get away from feeling constantly that you're not good enough, that nothing you do is ever going to be right, that you're not ever living up to these ever-changing goalposts and imaginary standards of your parent. So this is why I'm highlighting this in this episode, to have a look at these emotional manipulation tactics, because I believe that majority of parents, when they do these tactics, they don't realize they are doing it. They don't understand how negative it is, how it impacts their child's development, and how it impacts their future relationship as they grow up and become adults. And today I'm going to finish up this episode by talking about defensive coping. So these are one of the outcomes that could happen as a result of using these manipulation tactics when disciplining your child. And I need to preface this by saying defensive coping can occur without a parent using emotional manipulation tactics, but this is also a very likely outcome. So defensive coping is a common response to stress, and it is designed to protect someone from unpleasant emotions like anxiety and guilt. When we talked about the revision of facts, emotional overload, it causes a lot of stress to build up in that child, a lot of anxiety and a lot of guilt. And so what a child can develop is a defensive coping mechanism that could look like oppositional defiant disorder on the outset, but is a defensive coping mechanism as a result of all the stress that is building up over the years as they're growing up inside of them, and they don't know how to communicate with you because you're not teaching them how, because you're shutting down the lines of communication with them over and over again. So they have a very limited emotional vocabulary. They also have a very limited or low emotional intelligence. They actually also could be suffering from impaired executive functioning. Executive functioning, if you heard in my last episode, can be impaired by trauma, anxiety, acute stress that goes on for a long period of time in the family home. So a child would develop defensive coping mechanisms to deal with that. So what do defense mechanisms defend against Above all else, defense mechanisms shield the individual from the emotional discomfort elicited by stress such as anxiety. So they're feeling emotional discomfort, and a defensive coping mechanism is a way to help them be shielded from that, to help them eliminate the stress, because they don't have the communication skills they need to relieve that stress or that anxiety. So people are especially defensive, and this can happen in adults too, which is why I'm saying individuals and people, not just children. So people are especially defensive when the anxiety is a result of some threat to their self-esteem. So that's when we're talking about negging can very much lower a child's self-esteem, and they can then use defensive coping skills in a response to that. They also use defenses to prevent dangerous feelings of anger from exploding into acts of aggression. Guilt and dejection are two other emotions that people often try to evade through defensive maneuvers. So defensive coping is an unconscious process that becomes an automatic response. So it's unconscious, it's a response to a stimuli in the environment. When they are facing threats to their self-esteem that arises from stress and anxiety. So being aware of this is the first step to reframing negative thoughts when problems arise. So you may use defensive coping and you may not realize it. Your child may use defensive coping and may not realize it. So when you really look within, you may realize that, you know what, I do feel emotional discomfort and I don't really know how to release these feelings. I don't know what to do with them. I don't really know how to communicate them effectively. Or you may not have somebody to communicate them with, to be a sounding board or a help or a shoulder to cry on for you. So if you don't, you could end up developing, even as an adult, defensive coping skills. So this is called a maladaptive coping strategy. It's not something that a person or even a child is doing deliberately. And I hear this a lot from parents. My child is so aggravated when I ask them to, they're so defensive when I'm trying to get them to do something. And I ask them how they respond to them when they are frustrated. And I often see subtle signs of emotional overload and negging. So that is now causing a cycle of stress, anxiety, and guilt. And the child is automatically defensive because it's the brain trying to protect them from these extreme uncomfortable feelings, and they don't know what else to do with those feelings. So next time your child is defensive, understand that the behavior is a maladaptive coping strategy. They're not doing it deliberately. They're not trying to hurt you or get at you. They have adapted as an evolutionary adaptation, as a response to their environment, to cope with stress and cope with the feelings they're having. And that's why I say in all of my resources, especially the Ultimate Guide to Disciplining Without Damage for Every Age ebook, is that we need to look beyond the behavior. This is how you can look past the behavior. You may see a child as being defensive and think, well, you're stubborn. Maybe the child isn't stubborn. They're using defensive coping mechanisms because they have stress and anxiety that they don't know what to do with, that has been building up for some time, and they don't have the communication skills to deal with it any other way. So if you're interested in learning more about disciplining your child without damage, you can visit disciplinewithoutdamage.com. It is my website for my ebook, or you can visit victoriousparenting.com and see all of my resources. And then you too can discipline your child without damage. You don't have to resort to yelling or emotional overload or you know, shutting down communication and just, I can't cope and having to walk away. I give you the tools that you need to be a strong leader for your child and to look beyond the behavior and to see the root of where it's coming from so you can deal with it at the root rather than using it just like a band-aid and trying to deal with new behaviors that crop up. You're actually dealing with the root of the problem. And then you are building a new foundation with your child that will flourish and grow, and you will become victorious in your parenting.